Hey guys, today we have another awesome episode of The Burr Show. I'm your co-host, Chad Gallagher, joined with Joel Kraut of Burr Loans. Buy, rehab, rent, refi, repeat. Meet the inspiring people using Burr to create wealth and their tactics so you can too. Let's do it. All right, we have an awesome guest joining today on the Burr podcast. She is literally epitomizes the word hustle. You'll hear it throughout her journey. But you're going to hear some really a couple of unique things too of how she has burred different deals, how she gets private money lenders. There's a lot in this episode, actually. Maria is really awesome. She is one of my favorite guests we've had on here, Maria Acosta out of Texas. I hope you look forward to this episode, and I think you're going to get a lot out of it, no matter where you are in your journey, especially if you're doing Burr deals. So Maria, talk me through. So you grew up in Dominican Republic for the first 4 years,
mm-hmm.
then moved to the New York City, New Jersey area.
So when I came to the States, I actually lived in Cleveland, Ohio, but that was for a year. My dad came to the States first, so that's where he was at. So we were in Cleveland for just a year, and then from there moved to New York. So was raised in New York for a good portion of my life. And then from New York, I went to school in Rhode Island. I went to Bryant University, got my bachelor's in accounting and finance. So I double majored. So I ended up staying out there for about 6 years total, 4 years for school. And then I got a job at Fidelity Investments where I sold mutual funds. So I was in sales for a bit. And then the reason I ended up in Texas, Fidelity has another office down here. So I got transferred down here in 2012. So yeah, I've been down here since 2012, but I ended up quitting my job at Fidelity in November 2021. So been doing
that's awesome.
Real estate full-time since.
That's great. Was the segue from accounting to real estate, I guess that's actually a pretty natural segue, right? You're kind of used to managing a lot of data and numbers, and maybe you're doing the same thing now, just a little more hands-on.
Yeah. I mean, so when I was in school, I picked up finance too, just because honestly, accounting was so boring. I was like, there's no way that I'm going to be able to do this for the rest of my life. And then also too, I was checking out some of the accounting firms, and a lot of my friends were going to the tax division, and during tax season, some of these people slept at the office with how busy they got. And I was like, I do not want to do that. So that's why I kind of transitioned more to the finance part. But yeah, I've always been a numbers person, and so the real estate stuff, I am kind of the same way. I have a spreadsheet that I use to run all my numbers. So yeah, I like that part of it.
I love the journey. I'm curious. So you're working this job at Fidelity. It sounds like you liked it, but probably didn't love it. Felt like there might be some more for you to do. How'd you get into then? Is the first deal you ever did, was it a Burr deal? Or what was your first ever kind of real estate transaction? What'd that look like?
Yeah. So the whole deal with real estate started just because I was watching a lot of those HGTV shows. So honestly, it wasn't because I was forward thinking and I was trying to figure out, man, how can I build generational wealth and get out of this rat race? I was just hooked on these shows. I'm like, man, that looks really fun. They make a lot of money. And yeah, it just looks really cool. So I was watching Flip or Flop. That's the show now. Flipping Vegas was the show that I used to watch back in the day with Scott and Amy Yancey. So yeah, That's kind of initially what captivated my attention. So I was watching their show and they were just marketing a ton out here in DFW that they were going to be doing a program, yada, yada. So I'm like, you know what, let me go and check out one of these things. And it's very similar to a lot of those other ones. They get you to come to these hotels for, a day long conference or whatever it is. And they give you just enough, for you to want to come back for more. So I paid to come, for a second day. I think it was only a couple $100. And at that second day, that's when they showed us how to increase our credit card limits, right? So I had fairly decent credit at that time. So I had actually gotten, I was able to increase three of my credit cards to $30,000 each. And that's how I was able to afford their program. So I ended up paying about $40,000 for the program that they were offering. So I did that. And in doing that program, that's essentially kind of how I learned most or a good chunk of what I know, with the real estate stuff. And when I was at their conference, because they actually flew you out to Vegas. So I got to meet Scott and Amy. We got a book signed, you know, by them and got a picture. So that was pretty cool. At the conference, I mentioned earlier that I have a property in Michigan. Well, there was a company there that was selling turnkey properties, supposedly, to the students. So I was looking at kind of like the funds that I had available to play with, quote unquote. So I was like, all right, cool. I only charge 40 grand. I still have like $50,000 that I could do something with on these credit cards. So you're at this conference, you're all hyped, you know, and they have the company, they're selling, you know, turnkey properties. So I'm like, oh, let me check this out. So I sat down with one of their consultants, didn't really have a ton of knowledge as to what to look for when I'm scoping out these properties. But I'm like, ooh, duplex, like, I want one of those. Warren, Michigan, I don't know where that's at, but you guys are buying it. So, you know, it must be a decent area. So I dropped another $30,000 as a down payment to buy this duplex in Michigan. So that was my first initial, you know, investment with real estate. I bought that duplex in Michigan, didn't know very much about it. And after buying it, that's then what I kind of realized where I got myself into. Shortly after the tenants moved out, the property management company that was managing it, they said that they never collected security deposits. So I didn't get security deposits from these guys. So I had to get another property management company because I wasn't trying to deal with these guys. And when I got the next property management company, they went, you know, to do inspections. We had to get the city out there. The city came and they said that it was the worst roach infestation that they had ever seen. So I had to hire Orkin for a year to spray on both sides. I had to remodel both sides. So I was in for even more money. So it was crazy. But yeah, that was my introduction to real estate.
But Maria, these stories like this, when I hear stories that start this way, they usually don't end well. Like usually the next thing I hear is like, real estate's not for me, or I didn't belong in real estate, you know. It sounds like things have turned around for you though. I'm curious, like what was the, what
you powered through?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How'd you recover from kind of a tough start?
Yeah. I mean, so it's like, I've never been a quitter. You know what I'm saying? I've played sports most of my life. So like, I've always had this mindset, like I'm going to push through no matter what. And, you know, we're going to accomplish whatever it is that we're looking to accomplish. So one, I wasn't going to let that kind of deter me, but, I had to sacrifice a lot. What I mean by that is the property that I bought in Michigan. So they also had lenders there at this conference, right? So I was able to get a hard money loan, like right there on the spot. And I ended up getting a 3-year hard money loan, again, not knowing very much about what all this stuff meant. So I was just paying, you know, my monthly interest payments, yada, yada. But thinking the way that I do, you know, my accounting, my finance, I'm trying to map out, am I going to have enough money to pay this thing off in full at the end of 3 years? And I had been paying for like a year and change, almost 2 years. And I realized that I was not going to have enough money to pay this thing off. And so all I kept thinking about is, shoot, if I don't pay this thing off, like I'm going to lose this property. Because in my mind, I was thinking because the property was valued so little, I wouldn't be able to refinance it. Like a lender wasn't going to give me a loan because I think I bought it for like $70,000. So I'm like, a lender's not going to want to give me, you know, X amount to refinance this thing. It's too little. So I thought my only option was to pay it off. So here I am working at Fidelity, you know, my full-time job of making six figures at this point. I was actually listening to Dave Ramsey with my brother. And so my brother and sister-in-law started his program and, you know, wanting to pay off debt and everything. They actually ended up paying, I think it was like $320,000 in mostly student loan debt in like 4 years. So right. His journey just kind of like really motivated me. So I had extra time on my hands. You know what? I was like, I'm going to get another job. So I actually ended up getting another job at Amazon at their distribution center. So I worked at a warehouse, at their warehouse for like a year and a half. And it sucked only because they don't have heat in the winter. So you're like freezing your butt off, you know, and I'm there, you know, putting away packages and all this other stuff. And in the summer, sweating because they don't have, you know, AC. So that's literally what I did. So I just sucked it up. And that's how I made extra money to try and pay this thing off. I just didn't want to quit. You know what I'm saying? Like I felt I invested all this money, like I'm going to be able to do something. But also too, another thing is that I also saw results pretty quickly. So I finished that program. It was end of 2014, right? I think I finished it end of 2014. That's around the same time I bought the property. I ended up doing my first fix and flip in February 2015. So that first fix and flip, I was able to sell it. It went relatively smoothly, even though the whole time I was scared out of my wits. Like, because I'm thinking, shoot, are we going to go over budget? Like, what's going to happen? Like, you just don't know what you don't know. So I'm kind of just like freaking out the whole entire time, but still acting and doing stuff regardless, you know, even though I was scared. But yeah, I made 15,000 and that just showed me like, okay, this is real, you know? So that helped in doing the first fix and flip, but also too, I knew I needed to pay off that property. And so I ended up getting that second job at Amazon.
What I'm really curious about is here, before we get to what else you've been doing. So it sounds like you paid off this property in Michigan. Did you then refinance it or you just kept it?
No. So actually I paid it off and it's been paid off. I think I had heard from someone, like, you always want to make sure you have at least one paid off property. So if stuff hits the fan, it's like, all right, well, I'm selling this thing. I've been thinking about refinancing that thing, but yeah, no, it's rented. I mean, they're paying and it's paid off and yeah.
Yeah. I'm not a big, like, pay down all debt, as a strategy, but I will say I do really like the strategy of not being super high leveraged, whether that's owning one house or having money in cash or in a 401k, there's lots of approaches to that. But I think that you want to have some flexibility so that, you know, when rough times come, you hopefully don't have to get a second job at Amazon. You just decided to go for it. I mean, you, okay. So you did one flip. Now, have you continued to flip houses or do you now hold some along the way?
Yeah. So, I did keep flipping houses. So around Fidelity, I was literally only doing like one flip a year, but you know, finding deals in the very beginning, when you're initially starting, that's like, it seems like it's the most difficult thing. Cause it's like, you're very uncertain, you know, if you're running your numbers correctly and all this other stuff. And, you know, sometimes you're just not confident talking to people, what it comes down to at the end of the day. But yeah, I kept basically doing just one, you know, deal per year. And it wasn't until, honestly, the last couple of years that things really started to snowball for me, just because I ended up getting a virtual assistant. So the virtual assistant really helped me out quite a bit in that she took over the marketing for me. So what I used to do for marketing, after I'd get out of work from Fidelity, I'd pull up pre-foreclosure lists, right, from the different counties here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And generating those lists, it's like each individual document, you have to get the first name, last name, the address. Then I need to look up, you know, their phone number. So it was just like real tedious stuff. So I was doing that every single day after work and just texting all the homeowners individually using my Google Voice number. But again, when I got my virtual assistant and she started helping me, that's when I started doing, you know, a couple deals at a time. But not just that, I ended up getting a mindset coach too. So I have a mindset coach, and I've been working with him the last couple of years. So his name's BP Brian Ponciano. He's awesome. So I saw that he had been doing a ton of deals and he was using other people's money. And anytime you're not doing something and you see someone else, you know, doing something like that, it's like, man, how do you do that? Like, you've just built like this awesome track record and, you know, people just like want to give you their money. It's like, Maria, you can start doing it too. You have people within your network that you can leverage, you know, their funds and really start building up. And I thought, I was like, man, okay, if you say so. And he told me, you know, just start posting, ask. If you don't ask, people won't know what it is that you're doing. So I just started posting. And that first year that I started raising money and, you know, trying to fund my deals and stuff like that, I think I was able to raise a little over $1 million from people funding my fix and flip deals, but also two rentals. So again, I said every single year I was flipping about one, you know, per year. I was also adding some rentals whenever I could. So if there was a possibility for me to keep a deal but not have a ton of money stuck in it, then I would. But there were sometimes situations where I had to bring money to the table, and that's how you can go broke pretty quick when you have to keep, you know, and have all this money stuck in deals. And so that's when working with private lenders really worked out. So for example, right now, I have just under 20 doors, you know, between the three states that I'm in, right? And I have about $500,000 from private lenders that have loaned me money that if I needed to bring money to the table, or also too, sometimes like I'll take out just a second lien. Like if I need funds for something else, I'll just put a lien against that property. You know what I'm saying? And then I'll use it for something, pay them back and, you know, kind of go from there. But that's how I've been able to do all of my deals with the rentals and the fix and flips. We actually just closed a deal on Monday in Fort Worth. There was a fix and flip. I was going to keep it as a rental, but right now with the market, I really just want to make sure that I have cash on hand. So my options were cash flow, maybe $200 to $300 a month, or maybe make like 70,000. So for that particular deal, I decided to sell it. So we made like over 70,000 bucks on it. But all of that was funded by hard money primarily. And then I got a private lender to fund the rest that I needed.
I'm curious, how do you structure? So talk to me the difference of how you would structure a hard money loan with someone like the Burr Loans guys versus a private money loan. Oh, you know, how do those deals look different? Because my sense is that they probably look similar with a couple like kind of key differences.
Yeah. Yeah. You're exactly right. So for example, with my hard money loan, so if I'm buying a house, and also too, with all of my houses, I run numbers for if I'm going to keep it as a fix and flip or keep it as a rental rather, or I'm going to fix and flip it. If it doesn't work for both scenarios, then I'm not going to buy it. So that's one of the things that I always make sure that I do, you know, from the very beginning, because, you know, being super like just wanting to go one direction, like, hey, I'm going to flip this, that's awesome. But like we've seen, if the market changes and you're not ready to shift or pivot, then you could be putting yourself in a pretty bad position. So that's one of the things I always do from Jump Street, number one.
I love it. Yeah.
But yeah, so if I'm doing, you know, let's say I'm fixing and flipping something and I'm getting a hard money loan. And the only reason why I'll maybe do hard money versus getting a private lender, with hard money, I have built pretty good relationships with a lot of lenders that I work with, that if I needed to fund something relatively quickly, like for example, doing these pre-foreclosures, we have people reaching out to us sometimes a week before the auction. If I don't have enough time to find a private lender that can fund the whole deal, that's when I'll go, you know, to a hard money lender. But again, even with the hard money lender, there is some money that I need to bring to close. So typically what I'll do is that I'll get the hard money lender to cover as much of the purchase price as possible, some closing costs as well. And then whatever difference it is that I need to bring to the table with closing, but also to the rehab portion, I have private lenders that are willing to fund those. Sometimes I don't find those private lenders in time. And what I mean by that is I'll have to fund it, you know, myself first, but then I'll have someone maybe a week or two afterwards that then will give me the funds. So I'll get my, you know, money back and we'll put a second lien, you know, on the property. So that's kind of typically how it works. And also my private lenders, I set the expectation that if it's a fix and flip, you know, that we're doing, they're not getting monthly payments like my hard money lenders. With fix and flips, they're very cash intensive. Like I'm always paying every single week labor, materials. Like we're not making any money when we're working on this project. The money's made at the end. So I let them know that you guys will get paid, you know, your points, interest, all that stuff in principle when we sell the property. So you'll get paid first, but we're not making any monthly payments, you know, while we're working on the project. So that's how it works with hard money and combo, you know, private money. And then I've run across, you know, scenarios or situations where, you know, I do have people lined up that can give me like one of the properties, for example, that I did in Fort Worth. And actually, I think I refinanced it with Joel Binion. I had private lenders lined up for that one. So I had one set of private lenders. They gave me $150,000. So that's what I used to purchase the property. And then I had another private lender that funded the rehab for me. So I had, actually, I think I put all of them on in first position because my title company structured it that way. But yeah, they gave me all the funds up front. I did not make any sort of payments whatsoever while we were working on the project. And they got paid all of their money at the end when we refinanced. And actually, that was a property that initially I did want to fix and flip it. I had it on the market. We received, you know, a couple offers on it, but it wasn't the offers that we were looking for. And also we had a couple of things pop up. We had more rehab than initially anticipated. I actually had to get, you know, another GC after I finished that project, just because my GC and I did not see eye to eye. The quality had been going down, in my opinion, in regards to, you know, the product, and he had been missing a couple things. So we had stuff that popped up in that project that we weren't anticipating, but it's like that sort of stuff happens, you know? So I had to, again, pivot. I wasn't able to sell it for what I wanted. I wasn't going to, you know, be forced to do that, but I knew the numbers would work if I kept it as a rental. So I decided to refinance it and keep it.
So Maria, I mean, there's a couple things I want to talk through there. The one is, it's interesting. So you're toggling between your own funds, hard money, and private money. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hard money is typically a company like a Burr Loans or someone like that. Private money is I assume your friends, your coworkers. Mm-hmm. I assume Fidelity has tons of people in that world that have some money. What I'm curious about though is, do you find the private money loan interest rate that you're able to negotiate that maybe a little bit more than a mm-hmm. hard money loan, and that maybe even get better terms on that money?
Yeah. And honestly, that's why sometimes I do prefer working with private money, just because you can negotiate that. Like when you go to a hard money lender, they're telling you what you're getting.
Right.
Unless you have a really great relationship and you're giving them consistent business, you're not going to be able to negotiate that stuff, especially if you're a newbie. But yeah, that's why, you know, I like working, you know, with my private lenders, because I can negotiate that. Again, I don't have to make monthly payments while I'm also working on the project, which is a big, you know, benefit. But it's really crazy, because I think I told Joel this, but I have private lenders where what I pay them ranges, right? And I'm not seeing this like right the second, but I think one of the best ones I was able to negotiate. So I had someone loan me $60,000, and actually they're invested with me for a little bit more longer term, for 5 years at 5%. Wow. So again, I'm not saying everyone's willing to do that, but you know, for some people, if they just have money sitting around, self-directed IRAs, it's not making anything whatsoever, like I let them tell me what it is that they're looking to make. And if it fits our numbers for the project, then sure, let's do it.
Maria just said a key thing that most people listening will not pick up. I listen to what works for them. We always come to it where we think a certain number should be paid because we're used to that, right? Maria says she calls Joel. The range is, let's say, 9.5 to 12, right? We don't even think about 5% for a second. On one of my personal properties in Philadelphia, I just recently negotiated a 10-year deal at 8.5. I mean, that worked for me and the lender. But I let them lead, right? I might have started a little higher myself, and because of what we do, sometimes that gets in the way. And for lack of a better term, normal people don't think the same way we do. You're not hurting them. You're providing them a conduit to get a rate of return on their money.
Maria, so my next logical point, though, is you kind of glossed a little bit over how you found these private money lenders. It mm-hmm. sounds like you're starting to maybe post into like Facebook or Instagram, but I don't want to take words out of your mouth. How'd you find these people? What's that look like? How'd you get started? What's worked really well for you in terms of kind of building that private money lending community?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, earlier I talked about how my mindset coach was the one that told me, you know, to start posting on social media. So literally, I just did what he told me to do. He told me to start posting. So that's what I did. So I would put on my stories, hey, guys, new deal coming up, looking for private lenders, 30K, 50K, reach out to me, or something like that, you know, just really simple. And it's funny, because we overthink things like this. It's like, well, what do I have to say that's really going to captivate and captures people's attention? Like, just put something out there. Like, no one maybe even knows that you're even looking for money for your deals. You know what I'm saying? So that's kind of how it started initially. I would just post stuff, you know, on my stories. And then, you know, I would post, put something on my like Facebook post, Instagram post, and whatnot. And people look at that stuff. I actually have, you know, private lenders that have invested in my deals that I have never met before, but they've seen me, you know, through Instagram. I also did, the Bigger Pockets rookie podcast. So some of them saw me on there. But yeah, like when people see you more on podcasts, different things like that, and also you just putting yourself out there and being consistent about posting. So some of my private lenders come from, you know, people that I'm in different real estate groups with. So that's a good chunk of it. But others, again, just from posting on my social media, just being consistent. And actually right now, my virtual assistant, that's one of the daily tasks that she's assigned to do. So she's the one that actually posts on my social media asking for funds and stuff like that. But that's all it is, consistency and putting it out there to your network. But also too, one of the things that I do, I try and go to a lot of networking events, but not just regular real estate events. And I think Joel and I were maybe talking about this when he was down here. So instead of just going to regular real estate events where everyone is maybe looking for deals, looking for money, I try and go to a different event. So for example, there was an event last year here. So my dentist set up a real estate group for dentists, right? So there's a couple thousand people that are in the Facebook group. And so last year was the first year that they actually held an in-person conference. So he was telling me about it, because whenever I go to get my, you know, my checkup, I go to the dentist, we're always talking real estate. So he was telling me that they had a conference coming up. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to sign up for this thing. So it was funny. I was probably one of the only actual investors there, but it was all dentists they did bring, you know, CPAs and other people like that. But those are the kind of events I want to go to, places where, you know, there aren't a ton of other real estate investors. Another friend of mine, he's a chiropractor. He set up a chiropractor group on Facebook, you know, people that are interested in real estate. So I want to see if I can go to one of his events also. So just kind of thinking outside the box and doing different things.
You know, doing events like that, you really shouldn't let the secrets out like that, Maria, but I'll kidding aside for a second. Not thinking in the mainstream, but thinking a little outside the box like that. Think about how many professional, licensed and degreed people are out there that have good incomes, good credit, 401ks or something equivalent, usually have some cash in the bank, might not be millions, but enough. Their husband, wife, respective other will kill them if they take on another profession. They're already taking a lot of time away from their family. But instead of having the money sit at T-bill rate or less, to be able to earn 7-8% with Maria or Chad or myself is enticing to them.
Did you have any coworkers who invested with you along the way?
Actually, it's funny. I did. So one of the guys that I worked with at Fidelity, he's actually the one that introduced me to Bigger Pockets. So it's funny because I hadn't listened to Bigger Pockets. And I remember like where we were and what we were talking about. And he brought up Bigger Pockets and that like completely changed everything. But yeah, I have a couple of people that invest with me that I used to work with.
When I used to work in digital advertising. And when I was doing well. And when I left, people were like, Chad, where are you going? And I hadn't really been telling people what I was doing. Like in my day job, I was kind of quiet about what I was doing on the side here. And in the real estate circles, kind of people knew who I was, but I kind of separated them. And when I left, I was like, all right, well, now it's time to like really open up which I'm not sure I should have done that, but that's what I did. And I opened up the kimono and I was like, yeah, I've actually been, you know, secretly building this real estate thing. And people are like, you like mouth drop, you know, like you're what? You're leaving and you're going like, really, you know, what have you been doing? I told them. And it's interesting. I raised about $2 million for a syndication, basically from all of my coworkers, because they were like, Chad, like, I mean, I wasn't even going to try to do this, but they kept telling me like, well, like, help me out. And I was like, man, this is crazy to not like put something together. And yeah, so I think that like for people who are in a day job and building up real estate, I really like that model, by the way. I don't think you should be too quick to try to leave the day job. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you did both for a while, which I did. And I think it like is a really healthy balance. But by the way, the other thing you can do is like, I mean, those coworkers, man, a lot of those people make good money. Mm-hmm. Aren't going to want to do what you're doing in real estate, but want to kind of go along for the ride with you. Absolutely. Whether that's a private money lending or, you know, as like a syndication, I think there's like a really nice path there that works out for a lot of people.
I mean, you already have built the trust, right? Those people around you, Chad, at that moment, you were your peer. They trusted you. You had long-term relationships with them. And if it was good enough for you, it's probably what they want to do as well.
Yeah. I don't know if you got this, Maria. I got a lot of, look, I trust you. Like I'd have a PowerPoint presentation and I'd get two pages and they'd be like, Chad, I don't want to see this anymore. Like, right. Look me in the eye, tell me this is going to work. And I'm good. Basically. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you get some of that too, where it's like, you are the trust barrier for
his. Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of times it's not the project that they're investing in. It's you, you know what I'm saying? A lot of my lenders at this point, like they trust me, like some of them it's like, dang. And what I mean by that is like, one of my private lenders, as soon as I bring up that I need funds to him, he already wires it to my business account. I'm like, but I haven't even sent you the term sheet yet. Like, give me a second, you know, but yeah, no, it's cool. Cause we've done several deals, but yeah, they're, you know, it's you, the person, not always the project.
Do you guys both find as you keep growing along those lines that those investor lenders will now refer their friends to you as well?
Oh yeah. that Binion deal that I told you I was doing, one of my private lenders, he had given me $275,000 for another deal. He partnered with his friend and brought him in on the next deal that we worked on together.
Yeah, I think that's the best route. It continually gives you access, and they actually build out the portfolio, so to speak, in a different way of, you know, natural people that are coming on board for you. I mean, you can't really buy that. You have to earn that, and you earn it through trust, right?
Delivery. We had somebody who invested in our syndication, and they wrote on the, I met with them for maybe 15 minutes. I never even knew they were. It was my friend's parents was the, this, and my friend had invested in our syndication, and then their parents did. And in the check, they put my friend's kid, Reed, they put Reed's college tuition on the notes of the, and I was like, man, that is some pressure right there. Holy smokes. Like my buddy's son, who's like, you know, 1 year old, I'm now managing his like college. And they were just like, don't screw it up. And I was like, no pressure. There's pressure there. Maria, I'm curious. One thing I like to ask people is, have you had like a unique story come along? I'm a sucker for a good story, I guess. I don't know, maybe a bird deal that went a little haywire along the way, or something crazy happened along the route, or as a landlord. It just seems like some people kind of have one of those like unique stories of a different type of property or a different type of deal. Something came up maybe during the way.
So I'm doing different things with some of the properties that I'm working on right now. Like, for example, some of them are not going to cash flow what I need them to. And so I'm almost doing like a pad split. Is that what they call it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Explain what that is. It's like roommates, basically. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Why don't you do this? Take a step back. Explain the whole deal. So explain how you bought it, how you rehabbed it, and then talk mm-hmm. about how you're actually pad splitting. Is it a verb? Adverb? Whatever. Can we?
It is today.
Okay.
How
you're splitting up the rooms and stuff. Yeah.
Yep. So this was a pre-foreclosure that I bought last month. So these, or actually not last month, we're already in August. So they were going to auction in June. So this was a home that I purchased in June. And it was really crazy actually how I got it. Normally with pre-foreclosures, I buy these things the week before the auction, just so I'm not, you know, running around trying to beat the auction date and, you know, different things like that. But some of these lenders are just not the best to work with, because we kept ordering the reinstatement. Because what I was going to do was catch up the payments that were behind and then keep the mortgage in place and just keep paying the mortgage and buy the house subject to the existing mortgage, right? But the thing is, every single time we kept getting the reinstatement document, by the time we got it, it would expire that day. And they had no per diem on the sheet. So it's like, we didn't know like what to send these guys. So we ended up having to order like 3 or 4 reinstatements, right? So kind of fast forward a little bit, but basically it ended up being the day before the auction, Monday before the auction here in Texas. You know, first Tuesday of the month is when foreclosures happen. So it was the Monday before the auction date. And I called the lender first thing in the morning and I was like, do you guys have the updated numbers that you guys can just give me over the phone? Like, please. And, they did give me the number. So they had it. Thank goodness. It was like $25,000. So I had the document and it said that there were 2 ways to pay. Number one, go and pay through Western Union. So I was like, awesome. There's one at the Kroger's down the street. I'll see if I can go. So I brought my debit card with me and I learned that Western Union, you can't send payments over $5,000 and they can't break them up into smaller payments either. The system won't accept that. So boom, could not make the Western Union payment. Okay. So other option, I went to the attorney's office who was the trustee, you know, doing the auction, and everything, to see if I can maybe make a payment through them. So that way they can, you know, postpone the auction. Well, I get to the office and it's closed because it's under construction. So I call them and I'm like, hey, so can I make a payment, you know, with you guys, you know, for this foreclosure that's happening tomorrow? And they tell me, well, we need to have written authorization first before from the lender in order for us to be able to accept payment, yada, yada. I'm like, great. At the pace that these guys pick up their phones, this is never going to get completed. So
just to understand. So basically you're paying this off on behalf of the seller. Mm-hmm. So the seller avoids being foreclosed upon. Is that right? And you've got an agreement already set up now with the seller that mm-hmm. says, hey, if I can figure this out for you, you'll sell me the entire house for some amount of money, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Okay. Exactly. So at this point, again, can't pay through Western Union, can't pay through the attorney. So the other option was that I could get a cashier's check. So I went to Chase, got a cashier's check for the 25K. And then I went to UPS and I overnighted this check to the lender in California. So I, took a scan of the cashier's check. I scanned the UPS receipt and I emailed that over to the lender, like, hey, here's the proof. We're sending the payment over. Like, please postpone this auction. I did the same thing, sent it to the trustee slash attorney, just so we were all on the same page. I then called the attorney and I asked, hey, so you guys see that you're getting your money, you know, can we postpone this? And then they're like, well, you're gonna have to call us back tomorrow to make sure that the lender received it, you know, et cetera. And again, the auction is the next morning at 10 a.m. So I'm like freaking out because I just sent over $25,000 and I don't know if this thing's gonna get postponed or not. But very next day, 9 a.m., I'm calling the lender. I'm like, hi, I'm just calling to check in, make sure that you guys, you know, saw that I'm sending you this money and this is getting postponed. And they're like, yes, ma'am. You know, we see that. You know, there is no auction set. And I was like, okay, good. Thank goodness. But I also made sure to call, you know, the attorney as well, just to make sure that it was off the list and we were going to be okay. And they did confirm that. So I sent the funds. And guys, keep in mind, I hadn't closed on this house at this point. Like I had signed a contract, you know what I'm saying? And I had everything at title, but we hadn't officially like signed to close. So if the sellers, you know, wanted to renege, you know what I'm saying? Like I just made their payment for them, their reinstatement. So if yeah. they, you know, wanted to be.
But just side note, Maria, one time yeah. someone owed taxes and I played this game before I had everything perfectly agreed upon, written, closed on, mm-hmm. went back to the person and they were in jail. Between the time of me paying, now we weren't talking 25K, I think we're talking like 2 or 3K, but between the time of me paying off their taxes, like, I mean, we're talking a day or two later. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they knew they were going to jail or what, I don't know the whole story. All I know is, and I was like, how long are you gonna be in jail for? And they were like, you know, 20 years. And it was like, wow. There was no way I was getting the rest of that deal. So I you gotta be careful of those kinds of situations, but it sounds like this worked out well for you. So you then bought the property for how much?
So I ended up giving the sellers $10,000 at closing. So all in, I needed about, with closing costs, the cash to them, and also what we needed to reinstate, it was almost $40,000 that we needed. So I actually brought that to the table initially because I didn't have a private lender lined up right away, but I did end up getting, you know, private lender. So I got my 40K and also I got the rest of the rehab covered. So we're in the process of finishing up all the rehab. We had to fix the foundation. We had to replace the roof. And because there was a hole in the roof and water had been getting in, we did have to replace some of the drywall. So the guys are finishing up painting right now, installing flooring. And so the monthly payment for this house, it's like $2,300, right? Which is kind of high. You know, and so with my private lender and what I'm paying them, plus whatever it is that I want to cash flow, I'd have to rent this place out for like $3,000. So it's a 4-bed, 2-bath on a corner lot, over 2,000 square feet. But the thing is, trying to rent out a house for $3,000, like, there's like,
quick, you're, is that yeah. because you assumed the mortgage? Is that what happened?
So
they owed 20 grand in back mortgage. You paid that down. Mm-hmm. And then, but then when you bought it from them, you assumed their old mortgage as well.
Yes, correct. So I purchased the home under a trust. So I have it in a trust. I initially put the homeowners as the primary beneficiaries, but then I had them assign their beneficial interest over to me. So if their lender reaches out and says, hey, you know, we saw that title has changed and it's no longer under your name, I'll just send them the documents that say that the previous homeowners are the beneficiaries, but I won't send them the fact that they already transferred their interests over to me. So yeah, so my sub twos, I'm buying them in trusts now going forward, just so I don't run across any issues with the lender. But yes, I'm making their monthly payments. Yes.
Okay. So you're all in it for 40, mm-hmm. and then their monthly payment plus some other payments come up to like what, like $3,000. So it's kind of expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So with what I'm paying my private lender plus their thing, it's almost $3,000. So it's like, it's just too high. Like your tenant pool, you know, starts to shrink when you start getting to that amount. So when I was running my numbers, I'm like, man, I don't know if this is going to work. So I was thinking maybe, you know, I might have to sell this thing, but I try and go to a lot of different, you know, events and things like that. And so I met a gentleman that he rents out rooms and houses. And actually I used to do that too. I did that. And actually I do that for my personal property. I've been renting out rooms in my house the last like 5+ years. My roommates have been paying my mortgage for several years now. And so in talking to him, he was renting out rooms, but he rents out the rooms to people that are, you know, getting out of jail or getting out of like mental institutions and stuff like that. And so he runs it. So he kind of acts as the, you know, property manager. He takes a fee. And this place that I have, it's currently a 4-bedroom. So he came over and checked it out and he's like, hey, we could actually turn this into a 10-bedroom. So what we're going to do is that we're in the process now. We walked it this morning, actually, with my contractor that's currently there because they're going to start putting up the walls. So we're going to turn it into a 10-bedroom. So these are smaller rooms. Each of the people in there have basically twin size beds in there. And the property manager charges anywhere from $650 to $800 per room. So we ran the numbers for the property and we're going to be grossing just under $7,000 a month. He's going to get 20%. And then I have to cover the utilities. So about $400. I'm going to cover also the lawn and stuff like that, maybe $100 a month. And then after I make my monthly payment to the lender and my private lender, I'll be netting probably about $2,300, $2,500 per month.
Holy moly. So Joel knows more than I do about real estate, but there's no issues with like, I mean, if I tried to do that in most of the markets I'm in, that wouldn't fly. They would call that like a rooming house or something. Mm-hmm. How Texas, you guys don't have rules down there or what's going on?
There are rules, you know, for sure. That's why, you know, you have to work with people that know what they're doing. So the gentleman that I met, he runs 10 other of these properties in Dallas. So I actually went, I walked through two of them with him actually. And I think 4 of the 10 properties were actually on just 2 streets, like right behind each other. So I got to see kind of how he runs his operation and stuff like that. He has great relationships with a lot of the prison warden, different people like that. And so they'll send them people, but yeah, I mean, he's well connected. And so I leave that part to him. I'm just providing, you know, the location where he can do that. He made sure that there's plenty of public transportation. There's grocery stores, stuff like that nearby. Sometimes a lot of these people do not have vehicles, so they need to be able to walk and, you know, access these places pretty easily. So
are these week to week? Like,
so he does 30-day leases. Yeah. So it's 30 days. Yep.
Do you need any kind of licensing to be able to do that? I think to Chad's point, you know, in a lot of places you would.
So to be honest with you, I'm not 100% sure if you do or not. I mean, maybe you do. I'll ask him and see, but, I don't know.
Is it a certain program? Cause like I've seen, you know, more and more there's some of these programs that are coming about, which are looked upon more favorably by townships where it's like, you know, maybe the program is alcohol abuse and they're kind of transitioning people out of that or domestic abuse or different kind of programs where they kind of, not only is it a house, but it's also a way where you can kind of bring in a mentor or bring in a coach or bring in some healthcare or whatever like that. I've seen more of that. But this sounds more like it's just not a problem with the local.
And I mean, I think you definitely do need something. It's actually one of the other rentals that I have it rented out to a sober living company. Right. So
that's
yeah.
exactly like what I'm talking
about. Really popular now.
Mm-hmm. Well, man, Maria, that is an awesome story. And to turn it then into, and so, wow, it's I definitely want to see some pictures of that we'll splice into this overall thing. And yeah, man, Texas,
you know, a lot of times you see a lot of the original ideas coming out of urban areas where, you know, population density was so great that they needed to do that. You know, we've been converting living rooms. No one really uses a living room. They use it as a bedroom. And now you're seeing that sprawl out into suburban areas and more of the more gentrified areas. And that's becoming popular. You know, sober living houses and other types of group scenarios are really very good money makers, working good organizations, doing good things for communities as well. And you're seeing that pop up all over the country. So exactly in line with what Maria is doing.
Maria, it's awesome stories. I thank you so much for joining. Man, you got, you know, whenever I do these things, I always get more excited about in real estate, someone like yourself who really takes the bull by the horns and makes things happen. It's awesome you share your stories with us. If folks want to maybe get in touch with you for coaching classes or follow you on Instagram, what's your kind of like, I saw you on Facebook here. What's your kind of like social media platforms of choice?
Yeah. I mean, you could definitely reach out to me through Instagram. It's lady_hustle23. Or
fitting, by the way.
I thought you'd find that funny since you said something about hustling earlier. Yeah. I mean, Facebook is just Maria Acosta, or TikTok or all of those, but yeah, Instagram is probably easier.
Cool. Lady Hustle. That is a very fitting name. You are the epitome of hustle. Awesome story. But I want to ask one more before we go. Mm-hmm. So you say you grew up in Dominican Republic. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I was born there. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do your parents, I have to imagine they came from there. What do they think of all of this that you've done?
It's crazy just because like my parents, when I told them I was quitting my job, or at least when I told my mom, she's like, wait, mija, like, is that what you really want to do? Like, think about it. Cause it's like, people are so used to, you know, like always having jobs and, you know, having that steady, you know, paycheck coming in all the time. But it's like, they're proud of what I'm doing. And, you know, they know that this is something that I was passionate about. And I talked to them about my deals. And actually that first fix and flip that I did, my dad let me borrow $25,000. And that's part of the reason I was able to complete it. Cause my dad and my uncle both gave me money so I could do the rehab and fix it up. So yeah.
Very cool.
Well, thanks for joining us on the Burr Podcast. You are awesome. You are a hustler, and we'll add the links to your stuff. And if you can send over some pictures, that'd be great. But really fun hanging out with you today.
Oh yeah, definitely. Shoot. This is the first time I'm doing it, so I'm looking forward to seeing what this thing's going to look like.
Maria, thanks for jumping on with us today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for the invite, guys. I appreciate you having me.
Sam, Maria, thank you.
Later.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Real Estate Hackers Show. If you've not yet become a member of Real Estate Hackers, you can do that for free at realestatehackers.com. Get access to all the amazing real estate hacker deals from incredible vendors, a ton of content and materials for you, the investor. You can follow Real Estate Hackers on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. If you can give us a 5-star review for the podcast, I would personally really appreciate it. We read every review, and thank you so much for helping us grow this community for you, the real estate investor.